bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello!
And our longtime partner in podcasting crime, Mr. Bryce Castillo.
That's right. Hey, everybody. I mean, that's true now. I mean, I've been working on the show for 4 or 5 years now.
It's insane.
Yeah. Wow.
It's always been Bryce.
Yeah, Brian is on assignment in Disney World.
That's right. Yeah. He's going to find the Loch Ness Mickey.
Yes. Well, he's going to find all the hidden Mickeys.
Hey, you know, let's start right off right from there. Because, like, you know what sucks, Justin?
What's that, Andrew?
You're not at Disney.
I'm not. No. Brian is. His family is there with him. But no.
Family.
I'm not there. You're not there. Bryce is not there.
Not there. I'm so working.
Can you really say his family is with him?
I mean, knowing him, he's probably about 5 feet away playing Hearthstone. But I guess technically he's there. This is a family.
He's in the proximity of the Brushwood family.
Well, I mean, if we're not there, then is his full family there?
Oh, yeah.
So there was a cool article that was on Collider, but Drew Taylor wrote about this. And this was, there's the Disney Plus has the show, the Imagineering Story. And they said, and this was an article like, hey, things that weren't in there, they should be in there. And this is what I love about Disney is, you know, we all know Disney's creative and we see the things Disney does. You hear rumors about what Disney's going to do or maybe was going to do. But then you dig a little deeper and you hear about stuff that like things they were going to do or really crazy stuff or, you know, like that's we love Defunctland. You know, we've talked about that, yeah. That YouTube show a lot. It's just a wonderful deep dive into theme park history and stuff that I didn't even think was possible to get that much information out. Well, here they talk about, which is, I think, one of the coolest ideas was apparently at some point, one of the theme park designers, one of the people, Jim Cora, who was one chairman of Disney International, was seated next to a U.S. Navy admiral. And the comment came up like, yeah, what if you built a Disney park on top of an aircraft carrier? And periodically, surplus aircraft carriers are available.
an aircraft. Okay. Have you guys been on naval ships before? I'm sure you have, Andrew.
Yeah, what's that supposed to imply?
Well, I'm saying, have you, it's not the happiest place on Earth. These naval ships.
Well, I mean, aircraft carriers are cool. I mean, I had a friend in the family who was, you know, in the Navy, and I got a tour like aircraft carriers when I was a kid and stuff, and go on there. But you go to like the Intrepid and stuff in New York, it's a big, wide open space, though. You know, you go on top of an aircraft carrier. If you've been on an aircraft carrier, like you've got that wide open deck, it can be a very big space. So
yeah, I think the idea would be not, hey, take a look at the aircraft carrier as it is now, but rather. Yeah. If you're interested in cruises, imagine what you could do with the canvas that is an aircraft carrier.
Well, no, not a cruise. Not even a cruise.
I know. But obviously things in the water that are normally destinations would be a cruise, but this would be something that would be far, far larger and transformational.
Right.
Yeah, the idea would go from port to port. So right now it could be in Oakland, right?
Yes.
Guys, I'm going to be at Disney 2 right now because... Yes. That's what we do on Mondays.
Oh, okay, so a date. See, I was also thinking of a cruise, and you know, those ships are not exactly comfortable. But if it's like a day thing, like okay, I could see that, like a little pop up Disney pop up.
Exactly, it would pull into a port, and there would be a Disney ship. And so they put some effort into doing this. It was Eisner and Wells started working on some feasibility of this and trying to figure out what the practical. And they hadn't opened up Euro Disneyland yet, and it's one of these ideas that just sort of like. I guess faded away. They looked into maybe getting a oil super tanker because it has the holes and deck space and stuff. And so, you know, I mean, actually a team went together and started to put the thing together. They thought they could fit maybe like half of the amount of Disney's Castle Park, you know, in there.
Oh my
God.
And
you could go around the world, go to Europe, South America, et cetera, Asia, Australia.
I mean, this seems like a walking disaster of an idea from the jump, right? Because
I mean, the second anything goes wrong.
Well, I mean, I guess that's my point. My point is, and let's understand that this only opens when it's docked. But if you go to a theme park now, there are regular closures and maintenance and all sorts of stuff that goes on just by the fact that you are moving the volume of people that you move through these attractions. Anything at this level, when you're at sea, even if you're docking, you are at best downgrading your problems from it breaks at sea to it breaks on tour. And I know, you know, Andrew and I know people that have gone on these massive tours with gigantic props, and there is no shortage of folly that happens.
You're saying a traveling attraction with amusement park rides would never work?
I'm not saying it would never work. I'm saying that...
county fairs and carnivals. Justin says you don't exist.
I'm saying that for Disney polish, right, it would be prohibitively expensive and filled with potential problems.
Let me describe this to you before you totally drown this dream.
All right.
The top deck would be attractions like the Alice in Wonderland teacups, Dumbo in a Fantasyland theater. The stern end would feature a modified It's a Small World, utilizing the Omnimover ride system like the Haunted Mansion. Elsewhere, there would be an Aladdin and Little Mermaid-themed dark rides. At the time, neither had been implemented in any park. There still isn't an Aladdin dark ride. An Indiana Jones-themed roller coaster replacing a proposed Space Mountain, which would have been below the decks. And Star Tours, Fantasyland, Tomorrowland, and Toontown would be represented. While they decided not to put Adventureland and Frontierland where they needed, there would be elaborately themed retail and dining areas, shocker, and the atrium where you could initially walk through a Main Street circuit. Because fireworks couldn't be shot off from a ship, there would be a barge that followed the super tanker for that purpose, and an additional passenger ship was required for permanent cast members to live and sleep on, in addition to up to three ships, or as Hickson's put it, our own, very own Disney Navy.
Oh, so there are so many points of failure. I mean, all these extra ships that you have, an entire fleet that you have to maintain around this one huge attraction.
So, just so you know, though, the way the Disney Cruise Lines work now, though, because, you know, Disney Cruise Lines is very successful, very, very well run, in my opinion. I've been on them. And they have an island that they go to, and they have a crew that goes and maintains the island, takes care of things there. There is the ships. There's the shadow stuff that goes on to facilitate, make sure everything kind of gets pulled off. They actually do have fireworks on the cruise ship. There was talk at some point of putting like a bigger sort of like amusement park ride on top of there. But the theming on these ships is incredible. The details is pretty amazing. So I agree. This is fraught with complications. I think that's ultimately why they didn't do it. But they also hadn't had as much experience as they have had now with the Disney Cruise Lines and things like that. So it's I don't know. Still part of me is like, man, how cool would that be?
I think now, in a world where so many of these rides are digital projections, it's more feasible. Mm-hmm. Like, take some of the iconic mechanical stuff, the teacups, the Dumbo ride, some of the younger kid stuff that, you know, I think reasonably you can make sure that that runs, because that is, like you mentioned, a carnival, a well-polished carnival ride. Mm-hmm. Roller coasters, I think, are fraught with peril. But if you're looking at, like, you know what they're building now, like the Avatar ride, if you're looking at the Han Solo ride at Star Wars, these are things that like are obviously mechanically leaps and bounds beyond the teacups, but are effectively just hydraulic systems that you have a great 4K projection in front of.
Oh, hold on. I'm sorry. I'm just writing an email to Carnival Cruise Lines. I know you guys already have a roller coaster on your cruise ship, but Justin says it's a dumb idea and you should stop it now. I'm done.
All right. It's not to say that it is, again, impossible, right? It's just I don't know how often that breaks down. I don't know how often it's there. For the business model that they had, which was pull into port, I mean, I'd assume you pull into port with, you know, a week or so before you opened, right, depending on how – of long you were open, you'd be able to fix up anything. I mean, I guess it is.
We're looking at video right now. Oh, just an audience of the Bolt roller coaster on board Carnival Cruise Lines.
I mean, it is technically a coaster, it looks like. I mean, it's not, you know.
Oh, that's the baby coaster. The baby coaster at any theme park or carnival. That's the one that you come on. That's only.
Oh, I like how you're like, ah, it's not the can't be done. Well, it's done, but that doesn't count because you know I want a wooden coaster that's 100 years old.
Yeah.
I didn't want that. I mean, I just said that it's fraught with peril. I didn't say it was impossible. Don't put words in my mouth.
A boring coaster, Andrew. A boring coaster is also peril.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's really cool because they have a very simple coaster that really is there because you're looking out into the ocean, right? Like that's the attraction of that coaster is that it's at the top of the top of the ship, and so you get to see all these really cool views, and that's fun, right?
Yeah, and it's Carnival with a billion ships, and they're like, hey, what do we want to put on this one? I don't know, like a ball pit filled with eels? Okay, we'll do it.
Exactly, right?
Now that sounds fun.
Something to do differentiate ships. But, you know, with where rides are going, I guess my point is, with where rides are going, I could see this more clearly. Like with so much projection, when projection is such a large part of it, I can understand it more than trying to do something with the throughput of like a Space Mountain on there.
Yeah, that makes more sense for these sort of enclosed smaller rides, or like attractions like a Teacups or something.
But I could see if they were using things like the Omni Movers, and you had something as big as an oil tanker. Which, just for point of reference, was able to hold King Kong. You have a lot of space inside of there, and you could do something, you know, I don't know what the actual interior space, like, is it like warehouse size or whatever? Like, I think ultimately it would just be the operations and the upkeep would be colossally expensive to be able to do this, to maintain this. I would see this as a thing that sounds like a neat idea, but all of the things that you pointed out, I think you're 100% right as far as what makes it problematic and trying to moving everybody around versus what kind of revenue you're making versus, you know, what they eventually did with the actual Disney cruise ships where it's like, hey, let's charge people a lot of money per day to stay on the ship and then, you know, work from there and add cool attractions. And if you look at the Disney Cruise Lines now and you see what they have on there, if you're a kid, like, it's pretty amazing. You know, they have like, you know, whole Star Wars sections and Marvel sections and, you know, all kinds of cool interactive things throughout the ship. They do, like I said before, they'll do the fireworks shows from the ship. So,
yeah, I think it's an interesting idea. There is an element of it that I really do love. I do love the idea of, you know, Disney. Walt obviously wanted to take the county fair idea and elevate it to high art, and that's what theme parks are. That's what Disney had pioneered. That's what you know, his legacy is. I do love the idea of then taking that and saying, okay, but what's our traveling version of this? Like, what makes it so special that you remember it for the rest of your life, the day that Disney came to town,
right?
That is fascinating, and I can see where they wanted to do it, but I can also understand that at a certain point that balance sheet has to look terrifying.
I almost wonder if, I mean, this is getting away from the original idea, but if they just did a pop-up Disney thing on land or at port, like in port cities, where they can haul it around via ship and they can do big attractions, whether it's things like the Omni Mover rides or what have you, and so they're like in, hey, Disney's in Seattle for a week. Does that dilute the idea of going to Disney?
I think they could do a form of a Disney experience. Like they have like what's like there's like some company does like the big Marvel Expo sort of thing, and there's been those sort of events, and I could see. And I don't know how successful those have been, but I could see, and that's an event where they have like stunts and stuff and all that. And they take over like a local arena and they do that. And that's not, Disney per se, and even like the Disney live shows are produced, I think they're produced by Feld still or whoever, but I could certainly see if Disney says, hey, there's money here, this is a market we think is going to have a future 20 years from now, let's create an experience. And it might be like, oh, we're going to do the Frozen land, we're going to put Frozen in Miami, you know, for like Cirque du Soleil does, you know, like when they do an installation stuff. So I could see that, you know, and you'd want to make it a different kind of experience, I think. But yeah, anything's possible. You know, we've talked a bit before about Disney Quest, which, you know, Justin and I had, you know, been able to go to in Orlando, which was a neat idea, but, you know, had its own limitations as far as throughput. We want to take a comment from the chat. Was it Mantuba, whatever, was asking about, yeah, like, do you think with these floating ships and cities that they might become their own kind of like countries or something to that effect?
Mantuba says, do you think that these floating cities will soon just become actual cities one day with their own laws and regulations? Maybe when Waterworld happens.
I mean, if Peter Thiel has his way, right, or any of the other seasteading movement.
Silicon Valley really wants this. They keep saying that they want lawless lands where they can give their employees Adderall.
That was in a different brochure than I saw, but probably is.
I mean, and by the way, Bryce, living in the Bay Area, the employees need no direction on that second.
No, but every time I hear like, oh, we need a space where we don't have to like abide by the Food and Drug Administration and like the ATF or whatever, it just makes me think, well, they just want to raise weed and be allowed to hand out Adderall at the Monday meetings at Google.
Yeah, some of it is more like if you look at Freedom Ship and stuff like that, it's more like just a bunch of wealthy people want to kind of go live on this sort of thing and say, you know, F you to the world and be in their own sort of environment and be kind of live sort of totally free. Having lived on a cruise ship, let me tell you what, there are a lot of trade-offs. I think these ideas are interesting, but the problem is that whenever you see a ship, you look at this sort of self-contained thing, like, ah, there's the ship. Ah, you're set at sea. Well, you're bringing in tons. You have to have tons of food on board. You know, when you actually live on a ship or work on a ship, you see how much that takes to maintain that ship from every port you go to, all the logistics of getting food, everything you need to the ship, people inboard, onboard, off, whatever. If there's bad weather, having to go to ports and stuff, it's hard to be like the self-sustaining environment on a ship because ships are so hard to maintain. You know, that's the reason we invented ports and stuff was so we could go there and fix these things and load them up. So I would say that the problem is if you do this to sort of say, hey, we're going to go be our own world, if other countries aren't on board, it's going to be challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, not to say it's impossible, whatever, but I think you need to have a really good, you know, business purpose to do it. And I could certainly see that, like, you know, when Europe passed their like right to forget law and some of these other things that come in place that affect data, you could certainly say that like if there was strategic advantages for certain historical data, whatever, what have you. The thing is you don't want to do something for a purpose that's so egregious or immoral, like, we're going to give you gambling and illegal porn sort of servers on our ship because you'll get shut down. Somebody will find a rule or a reason, whatever, to do that. But I don't know. I see all the problems, but I could see that there could be a point where there could be advantages to it, you know?
Yeah, I think we're a few technological breakthroughs away from making, you know, semi-permanent life popularly viable. Obviously, it is viable now. But to your point, Bryce, it's not about handing out Adderall to your employees. It's about not paying taxes.
Well, yeah, and but it, you know,
like if you said something,
that's on
like,
the list. That's also down on the list.
I'm like seasteading right now, man. I can't wait to get the hell out of here. And they would list a billion different things. And then you said, all right, if you're a representative of the government, you don't have to pay taxes. They'd be like, okay, cool. All right, I'll just stay. That's fine. That's really my big thing.
Yeah.
So another thing to think about too is like, there's still a lot of islands. If you buy an island, most of your islands are in island chains or in things like this. But if you buy an island, you have a tremendous amount of autonomy because you know before anybody's going to set foot on there. And we have a friend that works with a friend that has a nice piece of property in the Bahamas, and they'll get a call when they'll say, oh, yeah, there's a ship. You know, there's somebody offshore or whatever. There's paparazzi there. There's this. And you'll hear, like, they'll get – the other people on the islands will tell you, like, oh, yeah, there's somebody here or whatever. So that's part of the advantage of that is that you're kind of responsible. You are on your own in many ways, you know. So, you know, think, oh, Bryce has already got the list of islands to buy.
Yeah, you could get the Windmere Island at the Bahamas, price upon request. Okay.
Mm-hmm. If you have to ask, you can't afford it.
Can't afford it. Some of these other ones did have prices. The Spectabilis Island in the Bahamas is $62 million U.S. dollars. That's about 460 acres. 26 acres, okay, more reasonable, $95 million for the Pumpkin Key in Florida.
Is that really reasonable? I don't know.
Wait, where is Pumpkin Key?
In Florida.
I know, but if it's off Jacksonville, that's a ripoff.
Let's see. Card Sound Bay in the Florida Keys near Key Largo.
Oh, yeah, no, that's prime. That's worth it. 100 mil to be right off the coast of Key Largo? Yeah. Hell yeah.
Oh, yeah. That and the thing, too, is like a lot of these prices like have gone up considerably because you've had, you know, as wealth has increased in certain areas, the idea of like, well, where do we go with this? You know, and we could buy the island of Patroclus in Greece, too. Ooh, you know, it's Greece. A good island. That's a good like Thermoskyria.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing is when you have a lot of really, 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 really rich people, there is the desire to differentiate yourself from other rich people. It's why rich people love buying sports teams because there's only so many.
Yeah.
Not every rich person can own one. And if you own one now, that's the thing. You walk into a room and it doesn't matter. You can walk in with the president of the United States and you're the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Right. Like and that's a thing that is forever for as long as you want to do it. And it's just that's un-F-wittable.
Yeah.
Hey, apparently we can buy Long Island, South Carolina.
Yeah. well, I'll tell you what, you can buy yourself a peace of mind if you head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. That's where you can spend your hard-earned money on this podcast. You know, we like to work hard every single week. Well, at least Bryce, Andrew and myself. We're working hard.
Yeah.
Really right now. You know,
making
we're not
sure every week you guys get a show.
Yeah. In fact, do yourself a favor and go on to the Blizzard app and just see whether or not Brian is live right now. And then just say, hey, the other boys are working real hard. Just feel like you should know.
Oh, I
and
think do I that can do that.
Listening to this. If you're listening to this later and you see him on there, just let him know that the boys are working real hard and you're heading right on over to patreon.com/weirdthings and earmarking your pledge to not go to Brian. So please go ahead and do that. Just put that little earmark on there and we'll make sure we take care of it. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Trying to see if there's anything within our Patreon budget here.
Oh, I guess it won't let me see his status if I am logged in as him. Someone needs to do the heavy work for me and see if he's actually online.
Yeah. So, man, did we talk about this? How Chinese authorities were upset at a farmer because apparently every time aircraft came near his property, the guidance systems would be interfered with. All right.
Okay. Like jamming.
Yeah. Yeah, like GPS jamming and, you know, whatnot was happening there, right?
Some sort of like, weird corn, growing weird corn out in China, huh?
It's one of these things where, like, you're like, oh, this is going to be interesting. And then you go, oh, wow, China. Neither of you heard this story?
No.
No, I didn't.
All right, great. I need my two investigators, your two Americans hired by the Chinese authorities to find out why.
I am Jim Jackson and he's Jack Jimson.
I'm Jack Jimson. Right. That's right.
Both two Americans.
We're Americans. Boy, you know what I love about America, Jack?
Yeah, what is that, Jim?
I love good old US of A, bald eagles, windswept grain and purple mountain majesty.
White picket fences, apple pie, purple mountains majesty. All we got them all, baby.
Exactly. You know, I like freedom and purple mountain majesty and cereal on a cold morning.
That's right. But apparently we got to go solve some of China's problems.
Well, that's what they call in. They know that the only gumshoes that really matter are from America.
That's right.
Historically, world's famous detectives from America. And so that's why they brought us in. Old Jack Jimson and Jim Jackson. Jackson.
That's right.
So, yeah, guys. Hi, I'm American, too. I was brought in to help work with the Chinese authorities to do this. The wonderful open Chinese government is very inclusive, is how we work here.
I immediately try to do the secret American handshake with you.
Yeah. Apparently, airplanes come by here. There's the farm over there, and we're trying to figure out why our airplanes are getting jammed.
Now, are there any? Along the lands, the landscape, do we see any like antennas, satellite dishes, maybe jamming-shaped devices?
We think the farmer's doing it. You know, we see some suspicious-looking silos and some stuff there.
Okay, silos can hide big things, Jack. I mean, Jim.
You see any mountains around?
A little far off there. It's kind of those beautiful, picturesque Chinese mountains here. But yeah, it's a little.
What kind of color are they? How majestic?
It's green, little brown, purple, green. Huh?
Typical.
Quite purple.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we check out the silos?
Yeah, you go. The farmer's off the property right now. We need to figure out why he's doing this. And so, you go in there like there's antennas. You're like seeing GPS jammers.
Oh, there we go, Jack. I mean, Jim, I'm Jack. There we go. Yeah, I think you solved it.
Well, wait, hold on. So he's jamming the GPS. But, Jack, for what purpose? Why is he jamming these? Why is a simple farmer out here jamming the communications for military planes?
Well, all planes.
All aviation.
You know what?
Anything that flies.
I bet he's in the pocket of big ground. Cars, bikes, scooters, skateboards. If it's got wheels, he's in their pocket.
Yeah, you know how many tricycles get pushed every single year? We're talking a million.
Million. 1 million of them.
$1 million worth. That's what, you know, annually. That adds up after a while, Jack.
That's right.
All right. So, yeah, you think that maybe it's a conspiracy. I think maybe, he's just a simple man with a simple plan. And that's literally stay off my lawn. And my lawn technically extends to the heavens.
That's right.
So how about you stay out of my airspace as well? He goes down to the local, I don't know how you say Radio Shack in Mandarin, but, you know, he buys a few off the rack pieces, puts it together himself just so people just stay away from his fields. Hey, by the way, what kind of crop is he growing?
Well, it's a pig farm, actually. He's got pigs. Mm, bunch
no
of
grain.
Pigs.
No ambergris of grain, huh?
Mm, yeah, typical. Pig farmers, huh? Mm-hmm. Real hog. Hogging the airwaves. That's what he's doing with these jammers.
Now, can I check a newspaper and see if there are any roving gangs of aerial pig bandits?
There are no pig bandits.
Because that was my second guess, is that pig bandits, obviously.
So wait a minute, hold on. But has he ever had a problem with things from the sky before? As maybe like somebody tried to come in and fly a plane over and screw with his yield?
I would say there's more accuracy to that than not.
Ooh, wait. Jim!
Yeah, what's up, Jack?
Is it UFOs? Is he afraid of UFOs? Does he think UFOs use GPS technology?
Nope, not afraid of UFOs.
Oh.
There was a word that came up here that's actually one of the words in like the headline, too, by the way.
No, I think that somebody used a plane to try and kill or scare his pigs.
Okay, a helicopter. Now imagine a helicopter with a big claw game claw at the bottom of it, swooping up the swine.
Yeah, no, I think we're locking in. Somebody was playing fast and loose with his crop, using an aerial machine.
Apparently, I'm gonna go jump to it because this will take us forever to get to it. But apparently, here's a problem in China for pig farmers. Gangs tell you, hey, if you don't pay us money, we're going to infect your entire herd, whatever, with swine flu. How are we gonna get the swine flu there? Drones. We're gonna spray them with drones. Put in GPS blockers to prevent gangs from spraying his pigs with swine flu.
Oh my god. Commercial pig farmer in China jams drone signal to combat swine fever crooks. Oh my god.
Swine fever, sorry, yes.
Oh my god, that is next level scumbaggery.
Oh my goodness.
China.
So just and there are cases of them having pulled this off. Yes, like weaponizing and, I don't know, making airborne swine flu?
I swine fever, I want to maybe clarify that. Okay. I don't know how related they are, but I don't want to, you know, misinformation. So, yeah, apparently, I mean, enough that this guy was willing to risk the ire of the whatever the Chinese FAA was with putting up GPS blockers and stuff because he's like, hey, I don't want this. And so that's and gangs will threaten you with that. Like, how messed up?
Buying swine, I mean, like, just even the biohazard of putting together a drone spraying swine flu is mind-boggling.
Yeah. I can't even wrap my head around this.
There's got to be some YouTube video on the you know Baidu version of YouTube about how to rig your swine flu container securely to a drone so it can spray over the herd.
It's even worse. The way it works is what they do is they infect the herd so the farmer has to sell it off cheap so they can go in and buy it. It's even more.
So jeez. And it seems like the swine fever is a pretty serious thing. There's another Reuters article here from August of 2019 saying that the price of pig has gone way up because swine fever continues to kill off pigs.
So Stoic Squirrel asks in the chat, who would buy infected swine? The crooks that infected the swine, so they, who are obviously of low moral character, can immediately sell it off as fast as possible before they can butcher them as soon as possible, as soon as they get infected, and they're going to sell tainted meat. This is why we get these flu things. I mean, I think I've told this story in the past, but I'll tell it again. As I graduated with my $60,000 degree from the prestigious Neuhaus School of Public Communication, the chancellor of that school during my commencement explained to everybody that the story that we would be covering as young journalists into the next century in 2005 was bird flu. Bird flu was going to be the story, bigger than climate change, bigger than anything else that even at that point people were talking about. He was very sure. David Rubin was very, very sure. Not David Rubin. Anyway, he was very sure that swine flu was going to be it. And that was at that time exploding out of China. If you remember, that was a big thing that was happening, in Canada. And SARS was another a Chinese-based disease that was spreading around the world. I got a feeling that there's some elements of the Chinese culture that are propagating situations like this.
Yeah, I could understand one thing if like, hey, pay us the protection money or we will kill your cattle, right? We will wipe them out and then haha. But then to go another layer deep of like, we're going to make your cattle sick, or we're going to make the swine sick so that you have to sell them off at a reduced price, and then we'll sweep in and get you twice, basically.
It might be that, like, in that area there might be one buyer or group of buyers, because also we hear gangs and we tend to think, like, you know, guys with bandanas and knives and stuff. These are businesses. These are like, you know, we've seen outside of China, like triad like level stuff. These are companies and businesses that look like legit businesses, but at the top, they're owned by people engaged in criminal activity. And that's the sort of thing I think that kind of often gets confusing, you know? And so what'll happen is you might have, like, you know, the inner kingdom meat trading company, you know, is actually owned by, you know, and I hope there's no inner kingdom meat company right now, maybe owned by, you know, some gang and, you know, certain criminal enterprise. And also what happens too is because they buy off the inspectors and stuff, because it might be like, oh, your meat's infected. Like, yeah, you're not gonna be able to sell it. We can buy it because we own the inspectors, and, you know, they'll sign off on it. So, you know, it's fascinating, you know, and it's not obviously a uniquely China problem with, you know, these issues or inspections and stuff like this. It is a big problem. And I would say that there's an argument to be made, like, bird flu could have been much bigger, you know, swine fever could have been much bigger, but because of efforts to prevent these things from spreading. And it, you know, one of the things that is amazing is how well it would appear to be that when stuff like this happens and some scientists there and some scientists here are like, hey, this is real serious, we need to together and solve this stuff, you know, they're pretty good at, you know, getting in and, you know, trying to prevent things from spreading.
Yeah.
We say right now the zombie flu starts to make its way through the country and, you know, room for improvement, but we do seem to get along pretty well on that level.
Yeah.
You guys want to do picks?
Yeah, I will do a pick. I was initially upset to see that the movie that I saw over the weekend was snubbed for the Oscars that I thought it deserved, and that was Uncut Gems.
Oh, man, Uncut Gems is so good.
Until I imagined in my head a scene of Adam Sandler's character, who is a degenerate gambler with an increasing amount of problems, freaking out because his character was watching the Oscar nomination announcements had lost a significant amount of money. And then I was made happy because I felt like I got a little short film version of Uncut Gems to play out in my own head.
Yeah.
Look, it's there's not a lot of why. There's not a lot of purpose. But if you like I can spoil the concept of the movie that Adam Sandler's a degenerate gambler who continues to get into increasing creative trouble. And that's pretty much it. I think it does a very Sandler's great. I think it does a great job of building up this very interesting world of circa 2010 Diamond District, New York City. But beyond that, you know, there's not a lot of, if you're not charmed by that initial concept, I don't know how much more of the movie there is there for you.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of twists and turns beyond what you generally know. And if you like that, like I did, boy, you're going to have a good time. If you don't, and like my wife, you're going to be like, what a boring movie. I knew really? He was a piece of crap at the beginning, and it turned out he was indeed a piece of crap.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It is a very kind of Todd Margaret-esque concept of just like snowballing problems, but
yeah,
I think it's so fast and really thrilling. The tension, especially in the last sequence of the movie, is like really you really feel it. But even from the begin, like that first 10 or 15 minutes of the movie, where it's just like nonstop, and it feels really like unfocused because there's a million different people talking at once. I thought that was really, really cool, because it got me in. I think this movie is really, really cool.
Yeah. There are, if you're a sports gambler, you owe it to yourself to see it. There's some, although the there are elements toward the end that will stretch credulity in terms of exactly how sports gambling works. But in general, there is a moment. There are moments. I will bring you into one moment where Adam Sandler is watching the first quarter of a basketball game, and his wife, played by Idina Menzel
from Frozen, I believe. Yeah.
She comes down to tell him, like, hey, go say goodnight to your child because, you know, he's about to go to sleep. And he will not leave the television because it's the first, in the first quarter of this basketball game because he's got money on it, which is something that just the interplay between those people. As somebody who was raised by a gambling addict, there were very hilarious kind of moments, at least to me, in terms of how true that was played out. But go see it. It's artfully directed. It's well acted. It gets great performances out of people that are not actors. I think there's a lot of people in the movie that this was their first movie, up to and including Kevin Garnett, who plays himself, the basketball player,
and like has a very meaty role and doesn't feel out of place. Like, he really takes to being on the screen really well.
No, yeah, and I think it sticks well within his natural charisma and exploits it for all it's worth. Uncut gems. I think it was kind of a sad thing that a performance like that, which was unique, did not get recognized at the Oscars. But whatever, it's the Oscars.
Yeah, I mean, look, if award shows made the right decisions, we'd never talk about them.
Wait, is it, you know, he did, you know, Punch-Drunk Love, he was great. And then is he being punished for everything else?
I guess so. I mean, I think that there is an element. I thought for sure he was going to get a nomination, just in that if you look at old people who vote for that are from New York. This is a very New York movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he plays a very only in New York character. It's funny to compare it to Punch Drunk Love because as a comedic character, Adam Sandler is, and you look at some of his roles at the beginning, like Billy Madison or Happy Gilmore, there's an element of sad sack to him, right? And that is really exploited by Paul Thomas Anderson in Punch Drunk Love, as he is the sad sack of all sad sacks who just gets bullied by everybody in the world, including his family. Whereas this movie, and you look at like Billy Madison, where he's kind of a schemer, right? Kind of somebody that's looking to take the shortcut. This movie takes that element and just builds this whole world around him, where he is this absolute cunning sort of you can't believe a word out of his mouth. The movie begins with him on literally, like, this is his last chance. He has abused every relationship he has ever had. He is at a point where it's the final straw. And then the movie goes an hour, you know, 2 hours and 10 minutes. It's I don't know. I loved it.
You know, the screenwriter William Goldman talked a bit about how actors, like leading men, won't do certain roles because just sort of ego. They won't. You're never going to see a guy get, you know, hit his wife or do stuff like this. Anything that they'll do bad things and do this, but there's these lines they won't cross because they're just fearful of the reaction to that. And, you know, there's some actors that are willing to be like, oh, if it's a great role, do it. But it's very rare, very, very rare. So, you know, hats off to him for playing somebody who seems just utterly reprehensible and likable.
Yeah, yeah. I heard an interview with him. He did a podcast with KG on the Bill Simmons podcast. But apparently one of the fans of the movie was Daniel Day-Lewis. Daniel Day-Lewis called him and was like, it's like, oh, my God, this is great. This is amazing, which Adam Sandler was blown away by.
Who cool. Adam Sandler played the cobbler. Daniel Day-Lewis was a cobbler.
Oh, there we go. All right. Yeah. I got a pick. I recently restarted watching this. I watched it when it came out. When was it? It's been 2016. Wow. It doesn't feel like this was 4 years ago, but it was. They've got a new follow-up to it coming out. I have restarted watching The Young Pope. Did any of you guys actually watch The Young Pope?
I did not, but I've certainly seen a lot of advertisements for the
new Pope.
Because the new series is called The New Pope. I didn't realize that it was not. I mean, it is The Young Pope, but now it's
not the two popes, which is totally different.
Which is a different Netflix thing, right?
It's not the slapping pope, who's a real person. Too many popes.
I wouldn't be surprised if that was like the Netflix play, was because you can tell when they in the advertisements for the new pope that there are two popes, and that's a big issue. The Young Pope is really weird. So it stars Jude Law as like this brash American 40 something year old who becomes the Pope, and he's kind of brusque and aggressive, and has a very strong will for how he should be, how his reign as Pope should be. And so he's bumping up against a lot of the politics of the papacy, the people who are the men behind the Pope, and how he sort of butts heads with them and kind of fights to get what he wants. It's very weird.
I started watching when it first came out, and I got like, I think Justin, you think you did too or something. I got a few episodes into it. And I don't know what this means. This is a crit, but there is an HBO template for the flawed man storyline. And it was the HBO flaw. And you saw that with Vinyl, and you see the stuff that worked really well for like Sopranos. And then they kind of sort of repeat that. And it was very much felt like I knew what the beats were coming, you know, because of that, you know, that. And so I sort of lost interest in it because it's like, we're going to take this and we're going to apply it to, we did the record industry. Now we're going to do it with the Pope, you know? And like, we're gonna get this guy who's flawed, and we're gonna dislike him for some reason. So we're gonna find out he's a little bit more likable because of his backstory. We'll get these flashbacks to this kind of thing, and I'm sure it's a fantastic show, but it felt very much like, you know, that.
Hold up, is he not just a trash bag the entire time? Because I was under the impression that he was just a trash bag the entire time, and that's I have not seen a single frame of any of the popes. I would assume that that's the point, is that it's supposed to be kind of a soapy, trashy, return to like those old Vatican stories where people are just banging and you know, just reveling in the excess
I would say that I don't know that he has like a redemption arc. I mean, with the way the Young Pope as a season ends, they don't really. It seems like they're setting up where the new Pope, the second season, could be something. But he's in competition with John Malkovich, who is brought in at the last second to be the new Pope. I don't know that redemption is really in the. Is a part of the story of this man.
Well, I didn't think, to Andrew's point, it's not like Tony Soprano was ever redeemed, right? Oh, sure. It's not like all these like flawed characters are ever, you see their humanity in flashes, but it's not like they are, you know, you're rooting for them because you're invested in the story, not necessarily because you think they're great guys.
Yeah, this feels... The thing that I like rewatching the first episode reminded me that I liked it as like a political thriller more than a character study. He just seems like a very odd piece that a political thriller is.
It kind of felt like I guess House of Cards would be the closest analogy, yeah. Kind of thing, you know, which is fine. I just was sort of. I don't know. There's sometimes there's like you just sort of you pick up sort of the pacing of a show and like I know it's, I'm going to be in these rooms a lot, and it's going to be this reversal and this thing and the thing they're trying to conceal and this sort of, and I could be totally misjudge it, but then I just sort of go like, I'm going to go watch Witcher.
I dig it. I think there's an oddity to having a Pope this young and being very,
handsome.
Well, A, being very incredibly handsome. And also just like being very disruptive. You know, he comes in and says, he's smoking and he says, I don't eat breakfast. I have a cherry Coke Zero for breakfast.
Yeah.
And they have to rush to find a cherry Coke Zero for him. And some of the interesting decisions that he makes in terms of like not really wanting to show his face and not trying to, I don't know, break out of the expectations of what you might have for a Pope. I think it's neat. I think our popely friends maybe did not have all the greatest thoughts about it. But I think it's neat, and I'm watching it to get ready for the new Pope, which I think comes in like a couple weeks on HBO. So, the young Pope.
All right, my pick is sort of relevant to today. It's a pick I've made before, but Tesla stock today went past $500 per share. And now if you've been following this sort of the Tesla sort of story, when Tesla had its IPO, it was at something like $18 or $20 per share. And it has had this very tumultuous period of growth and ups and downs and whatnot. Elon Musk is certainly, I guess we could say, a polarizing figure in many respects. And Tesla right now, its valuation is equal to GM and Ford put together. Now, valuation is what the stock price is trading for. It has not the new the profitability, anything like this, whatever. But it is a very, very, very interesting story to see what's going on there. Elon Musk famously got in trouble, which was this is my mug from August 2018 when he had the tweet, you know, that he could sell Tesla at go private at $420 per share, which now we know is apparently vastly underselling Tesla by considerable margin, which got him into trouble and whatnot because he's very frequent on Twitter and lots of money is involved. As a point of reference, I saw this on Twitter. I don't know if this is true, but I believe it's probably true. More money has been lost by short sellers. That is people predicting the Tesla stock's going to go down and agreeing to, you know, do purchases based on that, what have you. More money has been lost by short sellers on Tesla than Tesla has actually lost in its growth.
So,
to give you a sense of perspective, like that's how much money is involved on both sides of this, whatever. That being said, is if you're interested in the topic, the subject, whatever, Ashley Vance's book on Elon Musk, is one of the best biographies I've ever read. You get a lot of insight into Elon Musk. I think you walk away with a much better understanding. And I think that if you're remotely curious or whatever, if you like him or you don't like him, whatever, check out the book. It's a very, very good insight. And you get an idea of how he operates, how he functions. And having read that book and followed his story for years, it's like nothing sort of surprises me, you know, nothing surprises me, you know, and, you know, disclosure, I've owned stock in Tesla. I've had stock in Tesla since, you know, the IPO days. So I'm obviously a bit pro Tesla as far as its growth, but I'm not pushing on anybody because it is a very stressful stock to own when, you know, at any moment, Elon could come home, get into an argument or whatever, put out a tweet and go on Joe Rogan. And you could watch a good portion of your portfolio evaporate with one puff of smoke. So,
yeah.
But that book I loved. Love the book.
And to me, beyond obviously Elon Musk, like you said, a polarizing figure, I've always rooted for Tesla in that, you know, for the majority of my adult life, it was thought to be impossible that or thought to be a foregone conclusion that we would never have an American car company again, that we would never have a profitable American car company. And that to me is something that is worth rooting for, that, you know, we are the country that fundamentally invented and popularized the automobile and made it a global phenomenon and had, you know, our auto companies are obviously tied up in a lot of things that make them kind of very hard to kill, but also maybe not as efficient as they could be. And I think that the proof of concept that we can do an American car company again is good. It's good for the economy. It's good for American psyche. It's good for people who like cars.
And it's, it stirred electric car development. I mean, there are more electric cars being announced every, every couple of weeks, it seems.
Yeah, it's a big part of the future. I remember watching Tucker, the Francis Ford Coppola movie, with Jeff Bridges, which was the story, a very fictionalized account of Tucker, who was the guy who tried to create another car company and failed. And the walk away from that was the car companies won't let you, the conspiracy, it's not going to happen. You'll never be able to do it. And and it made a persuasive sort of like, oh, geez. And that was very much a personal story to Coppola, who had to battle studios, et cetera, what have you. And the fact that, as Justin pointed out, that here we have a company that is now worth more than Ford and GM says something. And, you'll hear like, oh, well, I've heard about this allegation here, whatever. Nobody should be beyond investigation or approach, whatever. But understand that when the point I mentioned before, more money has been lost on people betting against this company than that company lost. It tells you there are a lot of people that hate. And some of the stuff you see make it into the news, whatnot. Like, I see stuff on Twitter all the time where some people try to create this like, this export restriction is going to prevent self-driving from going overseas. And they will cherry pick things from some government reg and cut out the part that says it has to do with, let's say, satellite imagery or stuff like this. And you see people actively trying to influence the market against them. And that happens to the other side, too, people who try to pump it. But there is a real, real effort to try to push the stock down because billions of dollars have been lost. And it's not unique to Tesla, but it's one of the standout ones. And so you have to sort of step back from all that and go like, there's a lot of money involved. I don't know if I should believe anybody and just watch instead.
Well, I mean, yeah, look, and I think this has become a story largely because Elon has talked about it, and made it a big thing. He has pointed out that like this is a large amount of short sellers, and there is no denying that. I think Tesla was like the most, it still might be the most shorted stock in the market, that there was so much money betting against it. And to be fair, again, there's good reason why you would bet against it theoretically, right? Because it's never, it was thought to be impossible.
Yeah, I'm a believer in the value of short selling. Like, I've had friends who are like, they should. I'm like, no, it serves a real value. If you think a company is grossly overvalued and you think that they're going to underperform, whatever, it's part of market corrections and stuff. So I have no problem with that. But it's funny, if you want ever to take a deep dive, you go into Tesla on Twitter and you look at the different hashtags, like there's $TSLA.Q, and you get like, those are sort of all the Tesla bears and stuff. And you can just read this, every kind of allegation load you can imagine, Elon Musk is, probably going to be, supplying missiles to Iran or something like that, according to this. I mean, just crazy sort of stuff, but there might be, real issues there that need to be addressed too. So I'm here to say neither pro nor con. Just saying, it's a very interesting story, and check out the Ashley Vance book.
There you go.
So, gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.